Welcome back to Exploring Jewish Thought with Afroni Schlesinger. So an interesting thing happened. I had published the official podcast on why God created the world, and I explored three different perspectives. And going back over them, after it was published for a week or so, I felt that A, the perspectives themselves were in some instances mildly misrepresented, and that I should have been a little bit more precise with some of my explanations. And then B, I think we jumped in kind of in the middle of the picture, and there would have been a better place to start. So some of you may have already heard that one, and some of you may not have, but what I'd like to do is rewind one step, speak about some of the earlier sources where this concept is dealt with, where this question is dealt with, and then only afterward I'm going to record an additional podcast to go through the three perspectives that I'd already spoken about with a little bit more accuracy. So this podcast will be dedicated to going through the first sources, the earlier sources that address the question of why God created the world. And you'll notice a qualitative difference between the earlier sources and the later sources. The earlier sources really exist as slogans, you know, quick, in one sentence, why did God create the world? And it leaves a lot to the imagination. It leaves a lot to be wondered about. And it's not as satisfying. You don't walk out thinking you now have a good understanding of why we exist, why the world existed, and what that means in a practical sense. And that's what you get from the Mishnayot, and that's what you get from the Gemara, and that's what you get from the Midrashim, and that's even what you get from many of the Rishonim. Only later on do we start to see that these one-word, one-sentence answers, which have so much potential and depth behind them that are unexplored, we see those developed a little bit further. So what we're going to see is really the sources for the ideas that I explored in a podcast that has now been taken down. And later on, we're going to elaborate on those sources and really develop the idea slowly. So let's jump into it. We have a number of ideas mentioned around this concept of why God created the world, and I think we need to learn those ideas and put them into their proper context, and only then dive a little bit deeper into them and their practical ramifications. The first significant source that I want to mention is from a Gemara. It's Masechet, it's Tractate Yoma, the 38th Daf. And the Gemara in Yoma says as follows, Kol ma shebara HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba'olamo, lo bara ela lichvodo. Everything that God, the Holy One, blessed be He, everyone that God created in His world, everything that God created in His world was created only for His honor. Now, I want to address a question that you may be asking on this Gemara, and this is a question that you can ask on some of the other sources that we're going to see, both in this podcast and next podcast. And that is, what type of image or impression are we supposed to be building of God when everything that we know and everything that exists is for His honor? How does that immediately impact our impression of a God who creates things for a sole purpose of honoring Himself? Now, I think we have to keep a few things in mind. The moment you're learning about God, which is an impossible endeavor in and of itself, and everything that you perceive and everything that you think you know is either utterly false or just such a small aspect of the full picture, when you go into that endeavor, you need to drop at least one idea, and that is that you can ascribe human character traits to God. So the Maharal, in his introduction into Gvurot Hashem, which is his book on Pesach and of the Exodus from Egypt, talks extensively really about the impossibility of learning about God. Not only is it impossible to really know or to intuit anything about God, and he elaborates at length why that would be the case, but anything that you say about God is an insult, because even if you're trying to compliment Him, your compliment misses his greatness with such a large degree that it's nearly insulting. And that may sound strange because, I mean, you were trying to compliment him, but it's similar to, imagine you spend your entire day, you know, practicing whatever it is, practicing swimming. You spend your entire day practicing swimming, right? So you swim for 12 hours a day and you are excellent at it. And then some little kid who doesn't know what it really takes to be an Olympic level swimmer is telling all of his friends, oh yeah, he's the most dedicated swimmer in the entire world. He trains for 2 hours a day. Now, to a little kid, 2 hours a day of swimming is more than he could ever fathom actually committing to himself. And so he thinks he's complimenting you, but he's publicizing this notion that you're only practicing for 2 hours a day. And that's an insult to your actual commitment. He thinks what he's doing is positive and that's very nice. But if he understood, he'd realize that when he's speaking to the world about your commitment, he's underselling it so much so that it's actually an insult. Because half the people listening are like, well, I swim more than that. That's not all that committed. And, you know, if you take it out of the realms of sports and into something, you know, virtuous, let's say, if you do 12 hours a day of chesed, 12 hours a day of helping your community, and someone thinks that it's unbelievable, that, you know, it's beyond fathomable to do 1 hour a day of chesed, of helping your community, of some sort of kindness, then he's spreading the word of your kindness. It doesn't realize that he's underselling it so much that he's really insulting your commitment to the community. We don't realize that that's what we're doing to God. So our ability to speak about God is so limited. But the one thing that we need to keep in mind is if we are ascribing human characteristics to God, there's nothing that more immediately guarantees to you that you are incorrect in your assumptions and your impressions than the moment you start comparing him to human beings. So when we read a source like everything that God created in this world was for his honor, immediately our association might be some snooty king who wants respect and wants everyone to bow down to him and everyone to stand up for him so much so that he brings more people to the kingdom just so more people can be bowing down to him, so he can get an ego boost, so he can have some sort of false perception of importance. If we cannot ascribe those intentions to God, the intentions that exist by man, that pursuit of ego, that desire to be honored and respected for some, you know, personal gain is a feature that is just inascribable to God. It doesn't exist by God. And therefore, when we read a source like this, if that's the conclusion that we jump to, then we know that we're understanding it incorrectly. But then how do we understand a source like this? So I posed this question to a teacher of mine, a rabbi of mine in yeshiva. His name is Rav Horn. And he said, when explaining it, it's funny. I actually went to him and I'm like, listen, I'm bought into the system. Anything you tell me, I'll make it work. I read a Gemara, I'll figure out how it makes sense. I'm bought in, let's say. But if I'm reading that Gemara to someone who hasn't spent the last 7 years learning Gemara all day, every day, and hasn't decided that it is the map and the pathway to truth, how exactly do you explain such a thing in a flattering light? And what he suggested to me was to look at this Gemara and mitzad ha'emet. What does that mean, to look at it mitzad ha'emet? Rather than thinking, oh, well, God wants honor because that makes him feel good about himself, which is a ridiculous notion to try to apply to God and is a very false impression of what God is. Look at it mitzad ha'emet, meaning from the aspect of truth. Why would God, or what's the connection between a God and honor, right? Or what is the connection between God, who is, as we call him multiple times, the king or the king of all kings? What is the relationship between God and a king of all kings and honor? maybe it's not necessarily a relationship of desire that a king wants desire. Rather, perhaps honor is an appropriate accompaniment to a king. Meaning, maybe there are things that should be honored, not because the thing itself wants honored, but because they're deserving of honor. Let's take, for example, I feel like if we apply this to an inanimate object, it would resonate a little bit more, and then we'll apply it back to God. Take, for example, a Torah, a Sefer Torah. How much do we do to honor a Sefer Torah? Right? When the Torah is coming out of the Aron, we all stand. If the Torah is standing and in plain sight, we are standing. And we sit once the Torah is rested down. A Torah cannot fall on the floor. If a Torah touches the floor, the entire congregation fasts. People don't touch the Torah. There are harsh Gemaras, I believe it appears in Megillah as well as other places, against touching the Torah with your bare hands as opposed to with a cloth of some kind or some other intermediary utensil. Now, why do we respect the Torah in that way? And those are measures of respect, certainly. The Torah doesn't want this respect. It doesn't know it's being respected. But perhaps there are things of such a level of sanctity that they simply deserve respect. Respect for them is a natural product. It's a function of the thing. It's a natural product of its important status. The Torah doesn't want respect. But if you disgrace the Torah, that's an atrocity. That's a horrible, horrible thing. Why? The Torah doesn't have feelings. It doesn't know you disgraced it. Yes, but there are things that were worthy of respect. And you are responsible for giving it that respect. So if a thing worthy of respect doesn't get that respect, it's not a problem because its feelings are hurt. It's a problem because it's on some level, it's somewhat of an injustice. I don't know if injustice is the right word, but when something is absolutely worthy and absolutely connected to a certain degree of interaction, whether that's respect or reverence or awe, whatever it may be, it's somewhat of an injustice, or it's just completely inappropriate for it not to be regarded with that level of respect. So let's apply that back to God. And again, let's forget about this notion that God may be sitting in a high chair creating people to bow down to him for some self-perceived sense of importance. What if God were like the Sefer Torah? Or more appropriately, the Sefer Torah is like God in the sense that it's a product of God's sanctity. God does not want this respect. He doesn't desire this respect. He doesn't have some sort of ego that's fueled by this respect. But God is holy. God is sanctified. God deserves more respect than any single other entity that exists. And what if God is not being respected? Well, that's an atrocity. It's an injustice. It's inappropriate. You have something more worthy of reverence and of awe and respect than anything else that you could even fathom, and it's not receiving it. That's inappropriate. It's an injustice. So when God created things for his honor, that would honor him in some way, it wasn't to fuel an ego that we presume God has. It was to fix a problem with the world, to fix a problem with the universe, that something can be so worthy of respect and not be respected. That is an issue. That is an injustice. Things deserving of respect need to be respected because it's simply correct. It's right. It is appropriate. That is what it means to look at this Gemara, this part of Talmud, Mitzad HaEmet. Rather than what you think God wants, look at what is worthy of taking place. And God being respected is worthy of taking place. The Ibn Ezra, in his introduction to the Torah, has a bit of a different perspective. He says that God created the world lehodia koach ma'asav u'gvurotav le'olam. Now, we're going to see perspectives that take issue with that approach, but let's first just understand that approach on the surface level. God created the world and everyone in it to display his strength or the greatness of his actions to the entire world. God's actions are incredible. I mean, in a literal sense of the word. Not incredible as in, wow, that's very cool. Incredible as they're just unbelievable. It's exceptional. And the potential to be learned and the potential to learn or to grow or to gain from bearing witness to something so great is a reason in and of itself to create something that can perceive it. The beauty or the potential that exists in witnessing something so powerful and so great is a reason in and of itself to create something that can witness it. That is the greatness of God's actions. That there is so much potential in witnessing his greatness that it's worth creating something that can witness it. That's the Ibn Ezra. Rashi quotes a midrash. And this is the very first pasuk in the Torah. It's the very first verse in the Torah. It's not the first Rashi in the Torah, but it's a Rashi on the very first verse in the Torah, and he quotes a midrash. And the Torah begins with, Bereshit bara Elokim. So, classically that's translated as, in the beginning, God created. But Rashi brings a midrash that suggests two alternative interpretations. Rather than in the beginning, perhaps bireshit means bishvil reshit. On behalf of reshit, God created the world. Well, then we would need to ask, okay, well, what is reshit? Do we translate it classically as we would, beginning? On behalf of the beginning, God created the world? So that doesn't make much sense. But there are other uses of reshit that appear throughout Tanakh. You have reshit darko, which is a verse in Mishlei. Reshit darko, the beginning of his path, refers to the Torah. So let's plug that back in. Bishvil reshit, on behalf of the Torah, God created the world. That's a very interesting concept. What does it mean that on behalf of the Torah, God created the world? The Torah wanted the world to be created? Maybe the Torah persuaded God to create the world? What exactly does it mean that on behalf of the Torah, God created the world? The other potential comes from a verse in Yirmiyahu, where Israel is called, the people of Israel are called Reshit Tvuato, the beginning of his produce. So if Israel is called Reshit, then let's plug that back in and maybe it's Bishvil Reshit, on behalf of Israel, God created the world. So what does that mean? Because Israel has an imperative function in the world? Or because Israel can gain from the creation of the world? What does it mean to create the world on behalf of Israel? What does it mean to create the world on behalf of the Torah? Those are questions that Rashi doesn't answer for us. Additionally, the question of how the things in God's world give him honor is a question that the Gemara in Yoma doesn't answer for us. They're left as questions for us to explore further. The next source I want to speak about comes from a Gemara in Shabbat. The Gemara says as follows, Lo bara kadosh baruch hu et olamo, ela kedei sheyir'u milfanav. That God created the world for no other reason than for his creations to fear him. I don't know if that's the best in translation, but that's the first way I'm going to offer to translate. Now, two issues with this Gemara. The first one I feel like we addressed. The first one, if your immediate impression is that God is sitting up in his throne somewhere and creating people to be afraid of him, then you are overly humanizing God and it's warping your interpretation of what God is. We addressed that point. The second point, though, is why specifically fear? Honor, I can understand. And love, I would be able to understand. But love is a higher level of relationship to God than fear is. So why would we specifically bring fear? And I can think of two answers. Perhaps you want to say that fear is more natural. And so God would create people with a natural fear of God, but love is something you really need to work on. So if we're talking about what God created, then he created people with fear, but love is created by the people themselves and not God. Well, there's an issue with suggesting that, mainly because there is another Gemara that suggests that everything is in the hands of God aside from the actual fear of heaven. Everything is in God's hands except for whether or not his creations fear him. So that would be an issue with suggesting that he creates people with fear. But another interpretation of that Gemara is to suggest that perhaps there are two types of fear. Actually, I'll throw out a third interpretation of the Gemara. Perhaps if you follow the logic that everything in God's world is in his hands except for the fear of God itself. And the fear of God itself is literally the only thing that we can do, right? I mean, is that truly the only thing that we have control over? If I'm kind of developing this thought as I'm speaking, so let me speak it out. If everything in this world is in God's hands, what that means is that we don't have the final say on anything except for whether or not we fear God. Now, whether or not we fear God is not limited only to what's happening in our heads or in our hearts, for that matter. It's whether or not our behavior reflects that we fear God. Meaning, this is the Gemara that guarantees free choice. Whether or not we fear God and act in the manner that reflects our fear of God, meaning following his instructions because we fear the repercussions of not doing so, that is in our hands. So maybe we can understand this Gemara in a totally different way. Maybe what this Gemara means of God created the world so that people will fear him is very, very, very profound. And that means that God created the world for Yirat Shamayim. Because the fear of heaven is the only thing that he cannot control or does not control. The only thing that God does not have control over is the fear of heaven. So he created the world for the fear of heaven, meaning he created the world for the only thing that he doesn't have control over, which is free choice. Meaning the entire world exists because the idea of free choice is so beautiful, is so profound, is so powerful, is so necessary for the existence for our reality, that he created the world so there will be free choice. The world that existed before our universe was a world without free choice. It was a world of angels. It was a world of direct messengers of God. And everything that happened on that level was not necessarily good. It just was. An angel following God's instruction is not a good thing. It's like a computer following the function that you program in it. That doesn't make it a good computer ethically. It just makes it a good computer practically. What can make something good? The option to do bad and you do good anyway. Meaning free choice is the only thing that makes something worth existing. So if God created the world for fear of heaven is the only thing he doesn't control, and fear of heaven is reflecting in both our perspective in God as well as whether our actions reflect our perspective on God. So perhaps God created the world for free choice, because free choice didn't exist before the universe existed, and there is something so imperative, so integral to free choice, that the world must have been created for it. That God, so to speak, did not want to move on without, or something can only be accomplished when given the option of doing other, of taking another route. That's the power of free choice. It makes things good because they're not automatic, they are decisions. That's the power of fear of heaven. So I hope I was clear with that. It was really a thought that came to me while I was speaking, so I just wanted to speak it out. But I think that there's a lot to that. in that God, it stands to reason that God created the world for the only thing that didn't exist before the world existed, namely the opportunity to choose otherwise, free choice. Fear of heaven, which is not in God's hands, it's in His creation's hands, the ones He created by creating the world, the option to choose to pursue the fear of heaven and have your actions reflect the fear of heaven is something that did not exist before the world existed and was so important that it was worth creating the world for. And the last way of interpreting this Gemara that I could suggest is using Rav Kook, who speaks about two levels of fear of heaven. The first level of fear of heaven is a lowly fear of heaven. It's a terror, meaning it is a fear of repercussion. From that fear of repercussion, through a well-developed relationship, you arrive perhaps at something more like love, wherein, similar to your relationship with your parents, perhaps you do things immediately when you're a kid because you're afraid of being punished. But slowly you develop such an appreciation and a love for your parents that you want to do things just to make them happy, because you want to express your acknowledgement of all the good that they have done for you through your actions and the way that you treat them and the way that you do what they ask and even what they don't ask. But then Rav Kook says, but there's an additional and even higher level of fear. And it's a good fear. And I believe that the Rambam speaks about this fear as well. It is a fear that's produced by love and not preceded by love. And that fear we may know more as awe. Amazement, but amazement beyond admiration. Amazement wherein we're so awestruck by what we're witnessing that it's a little bit terrifying. But not terrifying because we don't want to get punished, but terrifying because we're simply in awe that something so powerful can exist. And that is a fear that is not defined by terror and does not precede love, but it comes as a product of love, and it's more like awe. It's more of a, can you get to that place where you have any degree of recognition for the power of God? In which case, it's not a fear of punishment. It is in awe of His greatness, that a greatness can even exist like this. And perhaps that is such an integral recognition for human beings, or just that's such an integral recognition for what God is, similar to what we spoke about earlier, that what God is will inhibit how God should be treated, that it's worth creating people for the power of that emotion, of that awe of heaven. Now here, the next source I want to discuss is a very, very interesting one. And that's a source brought in by the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, that essentially says as follows, Hityaetz HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'Torah. God took advice from the Torah, or He went to get advice from the Torah, about whether or not He should create the world. And the Torah says to God as follows, Im ein tzava, there's no military, v'im ein machane, and there's no camp, lamelech, for the king, al mahu molech, then exactly on what does he rule over? V'im ein am mekalsinat lamelech, and if there is no nation to praise the king, eze hu kvodo shel melech. What exactly is the honor of the king? So that's an interesting point. And it's a controversial point, not in the original sense that we discussed, because we no longer have those qualms with saying that perhaps God created the world and created people to praise and honor Him. We address that. But the idea of if there is no camp and no army, then upon what is God ruling over, does that mean in some way that our existence makes Him more of a king? Is God's kingship deficient without us? But once you create something to rule over, this makes you a king. Is that our function? And if so, are we doing something? Are we giving something to God? Was God deficient before we existed? Now, you could say, perhaps, well, even if you say God was deficient before we existed, it was always in his power to create us. It's nothing we're doing that makes him a full king. It's something that he did that makes him a full king by creating us. Still, there's a little bit of uncertainty, or a little bit of... it's a little bit unsettling to suggest that God was ever deficient, that without us, God is lacking something. And that's an idea that we need to explore further when we break down not just the slogan versions of why God created the world, but the fully developed perspectives on why God created the world. The Ramban suggests in one of his most well-known and most influential pieces, which is the last Ramban, last Nachmanides commentary on the verse of Bishalach, he suggests, "Ein lanu tam acher b'yitzira rishona, ve'ein el elyon chafetz betachtonim, milvad shi'eda ha'adam ve'yoda la'el shebar'o. Le'elokav shebar'o." Sorry. So, what is the Ramban saying here? There is no other reason for existence, nor is there anything that God wants from the lower world, meaning from our world, aside from the fact that people will know God and thank God for his existence. Now, actually, what I mentioned earlier about asking one of my rebbeim, how exactly do I convey this point in a way that doesn't make God sound like an egomaniacal leader, hope, you know, looking for respect? I really asked it on this Ramban. I didn't ask it on the Gemara in Yoma. I asked it on this Ramban because it seems crazy to assume that our only function in this world, that the only reason God wanted us to exist, was just so he can have someone to thank him. God felt like he lacked people appreciating him. God was feeling underappreciated up in Shemayim, up in the heavens. He didn't feel like the angels gave him proper appreciation. Or maybe because they had to say thank you, it didn't mean anything. God wanted people who could not say thank you, but said thank you anyway. It's difficult to process, but we've discussed what exactly that means, mitzad ha'emet, from the perspective of truth, why it may be so important that God have people who thank him for their existence, and even more important, as we suggested earlier, that God have people who could ignore what he did for them, and yet they say thank you anyway. And that's the significance of free choice that exists in this world. And perhaps that makes appreciation good, where appreciation that comes from angels is not necessarily good because it must be done. They have no other choice. Whereas appreciation from man is inherently more powerful and more of a good thing because we can choose to ignore what God has done for us. So if we choose to thank God, that's good. We overcame our instinct perhaps to ignore the good that God did for us. And therefore, it is a good thing to thank God in spite of the fact that we could ignore it. And maybe it's so good that recognition of the good that God has done for us is acknowledged from a place of choice as opposed to force. Maybe it's so good that that's a reason enough to create the world. Again, ideas that we already spoke about when we were dealing with the idea of fear and free choice. The Rambam has an interesting perspective. He says in Mor Nevuchim, essentially, there is no reason to pursue an explanation or an understanding of why God created the world or what the purpose of the world is. And the final source that I want to address is a very shocking source. But what you realize up until this point is you may have come in with the assumption that the world was created for human beings, that we are the pinnacle of creation, and therefore the world is created for us. world was created perhaps so we can treat each other properly, so we can learn how to interact, so we can learn how to build societies, so we can learn how to connect to God. But we haven't seen that in any source that we've mentioned so far. In fact, we will see it in the next podcast in one source, but even that source doesn't suggest that it's the primary reason. It's only a secondary reason, a reason that exists as a product of the world having already been created, but not a sufficient condition for creating the world itself. So the pinnacle of creation, human beings, what we may perceive as the end-all be-all of creation, the reason that anything was created, is never mentioned as a sufficient condition for creating the world. We're only a tool, a mechanism, a way of achieving, a way of achieving honor of God, a way of achieving fear of God. But it's not for us, it's for God. Rather, it's not even for God, it's for what it means that God should be honored and why that's important. What it means that things should be chosen out of free choice and why that's important. And this next source, I think, really emphasizes that point, that human beings were not the world wasn't created for human beings. Human beings were created for the world, in a sense. And this is that duality is reflected in the two iterations of the creation story, one that mentions man first and the other that mentions creation first, one suggesting that man was created before the world because we're created for the world, literally, and one where the world was created before man because the world was created for man. So that duality is reflected there. And Hillel and Shammai, or rather the schools of Hillel and Shammai, have a debate for years, or for a year and a half, something of the sort, where they debate whether or not it was good for human beings that we were even created. At the end of the day, was this a service to us? Was it good for us that we were created by God? They argue back and forth, some saying, yes, better that we were created than not created, of course. Others saying, no, of course not, better that we weren't created than that we were created. And eventually they both agree. It would have been better that human beings not be created, which is a bit of a depressing conclusion, all things considered, that it was literally better for us not to have been created, and yet we were created anyway. And perhaps that reflects what we had mentioned so far, that we are a mechanism, a method of arriving at a certain ends, right? Whatever is supposed to exist in this world, whatever the world was created for, we are supposed to facilitate that. It's certainly not for us, but it just could not happen without our active involvement. But alternatively, you could take it in a different way. And this comes from the conclusion of that Gemara, which says, but hey, now that we were created, you should be very particular in your behavior, very particular in your actions. Why should you be so particular in your actions? Well, because it may not have been a good thing for you that you were created, but you can make the best of a bad situation. Meaning, if you use this opportunity to work on yourself and grow and develop a connection to God, then you gain more than you lose by being created, as opposed to losing more than you gain. Meaning, the debate between Hillel and Shammai may be different than anything that we've seen so far. Wherein they say, why is it bad for human beings to be created? Not because it's inherently a disservice to us because we are just facilitating the end goal of the world's existence, which is not a good necessarily for us. It's an objective good that we are here to facilitate, and therefore we need to exist, but it's not necessarily a service to us. We just have a role to play. But that would be a fundamental reason why it would be bad for people to exist. Or rather, not worth it for people to exist from a person's perspective. But from the end of the Gemara, it sounds different. I mean, it could be a practical problem, that the overwhelming likelihood is that you will misbehave. And you will make reality worse for yourself through misbehaving. And when your soul returns to God upon your passing, you will be worse off having misbehaved in this world, corrupting the pure soul that was given to you, and you're actually in worse shape. And so better that you wouldn't have been created, you keep kind of the soul as a blank slate, enjoy that existence in the afterworld, having never had the opportunity to corrupt that soul, and that would be good for you. But now that you're created, and the likelihood is you're going to corrupt the soul through your misbehavior, that makes it bad. But if you take it upon your own shoulders to behave in a manner that is appropriate, you can actually form your soul, similar to how we spoke about earlier in why we do mitzvot from the Ramchal and the Maharal. You can actually develop yourself into a soul more worthy of the next world, and actually better your situation, so much so where it is a good thing that you were created, because when you go back to Shemayim, when you go back to heavens, once you pass, you actually are in a better spot than you were initially. So what that suggests is that perhaps it's not an intrinsic problem that we were created, it's a practical problem that we were created. The likelihood is we're going to make our situation worse. But that doesn't mean that we must make our situation worse. We could make our situation better. And perhaps that is a source for the world created being created for human beings. Not for God and not for an objective that needs to be facilitated, but the world was created for us, to facilitate our relationship to God, to better our situation and our position in the world to come, which is an unbelievable opportunity when you think about it. Now, the likelihood is that it will fail. But perhaps the opportunity for success was worth the likelihood of failure. Meaning, if even 1% succeed, the success of the 1% in that spiritual endeavor is so significant, so important, it was worth the risk of 99% failing. And that might be a difficult realization and a depressing realization, but nobody is making you join the majority for whom it would be detrimental. That's the word I was looking for all along. Detrimental that you exist. Everyone is given the opportunity to be a part of the minority for whom it was beneficial for them to exist. The world exists for you to use everything here to follow God and to serve God and to build yourself spiritually. You have that opportunity. No one is stopping you. Everyone has that opportunity. And now that you have the knowledge that this is why the world exists, perhaps, then you can decide for yourself that nothing is preventing you from being someone for whom it was beneficial that you were created, as opposed to detrimental that you were created. You get to be a part of the unique minority that connects to God through His world and improves your spiritual position and making it worth it, a beneficial endeavor that you were put in this world and given the opportunity to improve yourself. It is a model of little success, but perhaps we see that success is so integral to what it means to be a Jew, or to what it means to be a servant of God, or what it means to be a creation of God, that it was worth the potential for failure rather than, it was worth the potential for failure to have the potential for success. With that, we've concluded kind of the slogans for why God created the world. And the next podcast, we're going to get into three practical approaches that really develop the idea further and give us very useful information for how to live our lives, directing them toward proper endeavors and a proper mission. We get very practical information from the Ramchal, the Maharal, and Rav Kook on why God created the world, what that means for us, what we're supposed to be doing about it. So until next week.